Marshall Schott from Brewlosophy joins me this week to talk about short and shoddy brewing techniques. This is Beersmith Podcast number 217.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 217, and it's late June 2020. Marshall Schott from Brewlosophy joins me this week to talk about short and shoddy brewing techniques. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their All Access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your All Access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas and propane models. This patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller with exact precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and the amazing advanced settings. Whatever your setup, the Brew Commander offers precision temperature control and perfect repeatability. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. Order yours today. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 brewing software a try. I have a new update coming. Beersmith 3.1 desktop is out now. It includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and more. To download a free 21-day trial of Beersmith, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Marshall Schott. Marshall runs the brewlosophy.com website, which features a wide variety of interesting beer experiments, where common brewing beliefs are tested experimentally. In addition, Marshall has a number of projects we'll be talking about today, including Brewlosophy, the new Brewlosophy podcast, and his short and shoddy program. How are you doing today, Marshall?
I'm doing fantastic, Brad. Thank you so much for having me back on. It's been a while.
It has. It's been, I pulled it up on Skype. It was over a year, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
So how are things there out in California, I think, right?
Yeah, for probably the first time ever, I can say it's about the same as everywhere else in the world with this COVID-19 thing going on. Just been spending a lot of time at home and trying to, compensate in various ways for not being able to go out and socialize. So
it is a little awkward, and I think that's, if I understand it, it impacted your beer experiments, right?
Yeah, and it certainly has. You know, pretty much all of our, for all of the series that we run on brewlosophy.com, with the exception of one, we're collecting data from tasters, from participants whom we usually find at homebrew club meetings or at the local brew pub. And because of the quarantine, we just can't do that right now. And so we've tried to come up with ways to continue to produce content that don't involve contact with other people. And I think what we've come up with is okay. We've put the halt on some series, like the Hop Chronicles, where we kind of dig into individual hops. And then for, our bread and butter, the experiment series, we've been focusing on redoing past experiments and having the brewer do a series of triangle tests themselves to see if they can reliably distinguish beers brewed different ways. So,
well, that's hard because you can't, you don't have the numbers statistically to prove things, right?
Or the triangle test. Yeah, exactly. And there is something I think to say for if, one of these repeats confirms a past experiment test. You know, our focus has always been on more on the sensory analysis than it has been on the objectively measurable, compound differences or whatever else it might be in beer. So it's been interesting. We've been getting surprisingly positive feedback on it. I don't think we're going to keep doing it once we're out of quarantine, but I feel like it's working in the time being.
And I mean, we were talking earlier, a lot of, almost all the homebrew clubs have gone virtual. So now they're, I don't know about you, but I've had a tremendous number of requests to speak, to a lot of these Zoom clubs, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I've zoomed into one already. I've had to temper myself because I've still got, you know, a normal job that I'm doing every day and a family to take care of. And so, you know, one thing a week is my max, but yeah, it's been interesting. And Zoom, you know, I wish I'd invested in them a while ago. They seem to be getting a lot of attention lately.
They're doing very well. And interestingly, some of the homebrew clubs are saying their attendance is higher on the Zoom calls than it was on the in-person ones, I guess.
Go figure. I guess, well, that makes sense when you don't have to see people in real life.
People don't have as many things to do, I think, either. So,
Right.
Anyways, today you're going to update us on your series called Short and Shoddy. And we talked briefly about this last time, but can you remind everybody what Short and Shoddy is?
Sure. Short and Shoddy was a series that kind of stemmed out of my boredom. I mean, I guess you could say that about most of Brewlosophy. But I was home one day, 4 years ago or so, and my wife had taken one of my kids out with her to do some shopping, and I had about 2 hours on my hand, not enough for a typical batch of beer, but I thought, you know, I'm going to go try out a couple new things that I'd been thinking about, and I found some old Pilsner malt sitting, you know, a couple pounds of old Pilsner malt, some old hops in the back of my freezer. I had a decently fresh pack of yeast, so I threw together I think it was a 2.5 or 3 gallon batch. Using all that stuff, I believe it was fermented with an ale yeast at the time. But I did a reduced mash rest. I think that batch I did maybe 25 minutes. Just as soon as it was done chilling to as low as I could get it, I pitched the yeast, put it in my fermentation chamber, and then fermented it at, you know, kind of an uncontrolled temperature. The idea being just to see what would happen, you know, if I did all of these quote wrong things in brewing a batch of beer, kind of to prove to myself, you know, that it's not good to do that. Well, the beer ended up turning out perfectly fine. I served it to people who had no clue what I was doing or how I'd brewed it, and they all enjoyed it, you know, just fine as well. So that was kind of lit the spark for me to start a series doing this, where we go through the entire BJCP, you know, list of beer styles and brew every one using these, you know, wonky methods, reduced mash rest, abbreviated boil, for lagers, we're typically fermenting them at ale temperatures, typically fermenting slightly warmer than is recommended. And then, you know, taking various steps to ensure as clear a beer as possible, like fining with gelatin and such, and then carbonating as quickly as possible. For the most part, these beers get turned around in about 10 to 14 days and from grain to glass. So
are these controlled experiments? Are you comparing them to something done with traditional techniques or not?
That is something that we are working on. We wanted to get a bunch of styles under our belt first for the Short and Shoddy series. So for the way it works now is we'll take these beers and serve them to 15 to 20 people and just have them evaluated as if it was, yeah, we let them know what the style was and then just ask them a series of questions, pretty typical stuff you see on any like beer evaluation. And then we chart those responses and then share that with the world out, you know, to let them know how this group of beer drinkers perceived this beer, knowing that it was the style that it was intended to be. And shockingly, for the most part, the responses have been fairly positive. I think we've had a couple, two or three, you know, misses, but for the most, we've done almost nearly 30 of these things, and it's working out fairly well, surprisingly.
Wow. Well, yeah. let's talk about some of the techniques you use. So I think one of the first things you mentioned was an abbreviated mash. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, we know that you know, the mash rest is what you do. You soak your you know, milled grain in hot water, and you let it sit for a minimum an hour is what the kind of traditionally is talked of. And during that time, those starches get converted into fermentable sugars. Well, this concept of performing a mash rest for a minimum of 60 minutes, I think it came from a time, you know, when malts weren't terribly modified or as well modified as they are today, at the very least. And now today you'll hear terms like hot malt because it's so well modified. Running with that idea, what we're doing with the Short and Shoddy batches is reducing the mash length to a maximum of 30 minutes. Every once in a while, I'll do one that's 20 to 25 minutes in length. The idea being that if this malt is as modified as we're led to believe nowadays, then it shouldn't require a full 60 minutes to convert. And that's been the case. Now, there are some observations that I've made in my time doing these reduced mash rests. And one of them is that around the 20 to 25 minute mark, I get maybe 5 to 10% less conversion efficiency than usual. But once I hit that 30 minute mark, I'm within a point or two of what I was getting with a 60 minute mash rest. And so for me, that's what works, and it seems to work really well. I'm hearing from a bunch of people, in fact, who have just kind of overall reduced their mash rest to 30 minutes because of this.
Yeah. And I think you're probably supported by theory, because like you said, all the malts we're working with today are highly modified, which highly modified just means that they have a huge number of enzymes in them. And, yeah. And so that really does drive, potentially shorter times. I know a lot of times when I go and do an iodine test, sometimes as quick as 20 minutes, it's almost done, you know?
Yeah, there was a really great experiment run by Kai Troister, who I don't believe is doing much these days, but browkaiser.com, where he did a series, the same small, I think it was like a pint mash, but at different times measured the conversion. And at 15 minutes, he was over 50% conversion, I believe. And then it was right around that 30 minute mark for him as well, that you started to see a plateau, right? And so I just think it's neat to be able, if you've got kids or if you've got a busy life and you still want to brew, to be able to cut down at least a half an hour from your brew day by reducing your mash rest. Pretty convenient.
Now, the only concern I'd have is, do you have any issues like maybe a high finishing gravity or something like that? If you have a batch that you mentioned, a batch or two that didn't convert as well as you might have hoped.
Yeah, what I've found is over the few years that I've been doing this short and shoddy brewing fairly consistently, is that if I get a slightly worse conversion than I expected, then usually that carries through in attenuation as well. So the finishing gravity will not be as high as expected, but it will still attenuate about the same. Unless there's something going on with the mash temperature, of course, which we've shown over and over again that to support basically the fact out there that if you mash warm, you're going to get less attenuation. If you mash low, you're going to get more attenuation, a drier beer. Now, how that pans out in terms of sensory analysis is one thing. That's pretty interesting stuff as well. But yeah, the mash length doesn't seem to have much of an impact on attenuation overall, at least in my experience.
And I assume that's if you do it to a certain amount, right? I mean, obviously, if you cut it way short, you're going to have problems, I would think, right?
Yeah, the one time I did, just for fun, I don't even know if I wrote about this one, I did a 15-minute mash, and I just don't think it fully converted. The beer was really hazy. It had kind of a when you eat dry malt, it had more of that flavor than it did your typical, fermented malt character. And again, beer just stayed super hazy and didn't ferment out really well. But I think once you get past, as long as you have that conversion there, once you get past that 20 minute mark or so, it seems to work out fine if you're willing to take a small hit in your conversion efficiency overall.
I mentioned the iodine test. Have you done the iodine test just to check? I mean, because a lot of times that's what I do if I want to cut things short.
Yeah, in the very beginning, I was doing it probably the first five batches. I did it just as kind of proof to myself. But when every single time at 20 minutes, it's converted, at least per the iodine test, I feel like it's not necessary at this point. Every once in a while, if I'm trying a new craft malt, which it's really cool to see all these new craft maltsters out there, I'll give it a shot just to see if things are, maybe perhaps they're less modified. But that hasn't been the case. That 20 minutes, I'm getting conversion. So,
and you probably wouldn't want to do this with, a lot of adjunct, very high adjunct or very high non-barley malt, I would think, right? Something like a wit where you get unmalted wheat,
Right. Yeah. I feel like we haven't done that one yet. We're getting to it. But we've done, I think the highest adjunct short and shoddy beer that I've made officially has been a New England IPA that had about 20% of, flaked oats in it. And per the observation, that 30-minute, the 30-minute mash rest seemed to do the same thing as a 60-minute did. I didn't notice any big.
Yeah, well, the flaked oats probably wouldn't be an issue because they're flaked and they don't add a lot of fermentables anyways, sure. Right? Very little fermentables in them to start with. So,
Another
thing you mentioned was the use of an abbreviated boil.
This is a big one. There's a lot of a pretty strong belief in the brewing community that if you don't boil long and hard, that you'll end up with a beer that has what some describe as like a creamed corn flavor, DMS. I tend to experience DMS as being more ketchup-y, kind of old tomato. And so, you know, the recommendation has always been, you got to boil for a minimum of 60 minutes. And especially if you're using Pilsner malt, you have to boil for a minimum of 90 minutes. We kind of threw that to the wind as well, and never boil any of our short and shoddy beers for more than a half an hour. And, we've not noticed any DMS in any of the beers that we've made brewed this way. We have an experiment that kind of influenced motivated me to adopt the 30-minute boil as a part of the Short and Shoddy series, where we compared a beer that was made with, I believe, 94% Pilsner malt, split between two kettles. One was boiled for 90 minutes as per the recommendation, and the other was boiled for just 30 minutes. The sensory analysis showed that those beers were indistinguishable, again, on a sensory level, but that wasn't good enough for us. And so we actually sent samples in to be tested for actual levels of DMS. And the 90-minute beers you might expect had no measurable levels of DMS in it. The 30-minute beer had the exact same amount of DMS as the 90-minute beer, which was none, essentially. So, again, you know, that you look at that and you're going, okay, perhaps there's something about modern developments in malting that are making or allowing us to be able to cut time off of these, these certain steps.
Yeah, I'm trying to think the underlying chemistry. I think there's something called SMM, which is it's amino acid or something in the malt, and that's actually what turns into DMS.
Right.
Boiling it reduces it. So that's
That's exactly how that works. You know, malt is known to have, like you said, S-methylmethionine, which is SMM, and that's the precursor to DMS that gets converted in the mash and then, you know, taken off or boiled off. Purportedly during the boil, volatilizes off. I don't know where I did research way back when I was starting these experiments, and I don't know where the idea that 60 minutes particularly comes from. I think perhaps somebody threw a dart and it stuck on an hour. It doesn't seem to have, you know, there's not enough there anymore these days. I've heard different theories that a lot of the DMS or the SMM is volatilized during the kilning process, the malting process, and that even in the mash, there's really not that much there. I don't know. What I can speak to is on the sensory side, and as well as the one objective test that we had done, it just doesn't seem to be as big of an issue as I was taught. I was told to be very concerned about boil length. And I remember just 6-7 years ago, people saying, just boil everything for 90 minutes. You don't want DMS in your beer. I've never gotten it, that as far as I'm aware. You know?
I've tasted it in lighter beers. So I've had samples that people have given me that have DMS in them. But I think it does exist. But these are fairly light, like lagers, very light ales, those kinds of things.
Sure. I know it exists. Yeah. I actually thought for a time that I had tasted DMS in beers that, that I picked up something corny, to use a generic term, in. Then I got two different flavor samples of DMS, and both times spiking a beer with DMS, the experience, that I got from it was not what I was picking up in those beers before. So unless it presents itself differently, I'm not confident I was actually perceiving DMS as much as, maybe I was picking up some sort of a malt note from that particular batch of malt. I don't know. But to me, the DMS thing is very ketchup-y. It's very tomato-y. And that's something that I've not gotten in many beers, to be honest. It's not to say that I love every beer that I drink, but
yeah. I mean, this kind of fits in with the no-chill philosophy too, right? A lot of people are doing no-chill now, and no-chill, the big risk, of course, would be that you'd get DMS in it, but you say it's not happening, at least for the malts you're using. So that's good.
I think the no-chill method is cool. I think it's valid. We've done an experiment comparing a no-chilled beer to a quick-chilled beer using an immersion chiller. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, it did come back significant. Those beers were pretty easy to tell apart. The thing is that that's, you can't really parse out what made it different. And in my, you know, to my tastes, it was the bitterness level. One of the things with no chill is they've come up with these charts, you know, if you're going to do no chill, you want to throw in your hops 20 minutes later than you usually would in the kettle and all that. So to me, I just wonder if it wasn't something from the hopping or something like that. I didn't pick up what I experienced to be DMS in a no chilled beer. And if there is a shorter or shoddier method, I think, you know, no chill might take the cake on that. We don't do that regularly, only because chilling with an immersion chiller is so fast, you know?
Yeah. And, no chill, as you mentioned, no chill obviously is going to significantly affect your IBU level and your Whirlpool hop profile, just because the wort's hot for that long, that much longer. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it seems to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, another shortcut you mentioned was directly pitching yeast with no starter, or I assume you're probably not doing hydration if you're doing you're doing liquid yeast mostly, I think, right?
Yeah, we are using almost primarily these days imperial yeast, which, you know, the thing about them is that they send you yeast that has 200 billion cells in the pouch, and that's really part of the reason that we decided
and,
to
and start that's about direct. That's a, let me note, that's about double that most of the other major brands provide typically. Right.
Typically it is. And I've talked to some people, you know, who have done cell counts on the various labs, all great labs. I'm trying to show favorites here. And, you know, oftentimes if you pick up one that says it has 100 billion cells, you might have 88 billion cells or maybe 65 billion cells. What we've been hearing from people who are testing the Imperial pouches is that they're usually slightly over that 200 billion cell mark. So, you know, you're, for the most part, for most normal OG ales and lagers, lagers that are fermented warm, which I'm sure we'll get to, the pitch rate just a single pouch is actually pretty decent. It's not like we're significantly under pitching these beers. That's not to say we haven't. And I think, you know, the thinking behind pitch rate when it comes to the short and shoddy thing is there's a lot that we do as brewers to reduce the risk of something bad going on, of something bad happening in the beer. That's not necessarily a guarantee that something bad will happen if you underpitch, but it reduces the risk of something bad happening. And so because of the nature of this series, of the short and shoddy series, our idea is, well, let's kind of sweep away the risk reduction component of it and see where we end up. We've had really good results. We're very lucky in that we have not ruined any beers based on fermentation stuff at this point yet, at least.
But I mean, fermentation is a risk. Anytime you ferment something, you know, there's a whole bunch of off flavors that can come from fermentation, and putting stress on the yeast is bad too. But as you point out, one of the nice things is these commercial yeasts that are provided today are really, really pure. That's a big positive, yeah. Right?
Oh yeah, they're incredibly pure. They're, you know, and I feel like every year it's almost like with technology, you know, every year it seems we learn more and more about brewing in general, but all of these separate, you know, these kind of subsects of brewing, whether that's ingredients or gear, you start to see advancements coming faster and faster. And I can't separate myself from thinking that that's not having a huge impact on what we can get away with nowadays. You know, their ability to produce yeast the way that they do, as pure as it is, as clean, you know, as high a pitch rates as we're getting nowadays. It's pretty fantastic to be in this time that we're in.
And I guess, you know, we look at the theory under pitching, you know, it doesn't necessarily create strain on the yeast immediately. And right. Also, you know, as long as you're within, I don't know what it is, like a factor of five or so, the yeast will grow to fill the space, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, people who study fermentation, you know, most homebrewers are likely know that the three main phases fermentation, you got your lag phase, which is basically that yeast just about 24 hours, that yeast is just getting ready to do its thing before it moves into what we think is one of the more important phases, which is the exponential growth phase, which is where they say a lot of that flavor development occurs. Another thing that we do with the short and shoddy approach is we typically pitch warm which is kind of funny because back in the day when I first got started, which was 2003, it was often recommended to pitch while your wort was around 70 to 73 degrees Fahrenheit, which I believe is about, 21, 22 degrees Celsius or so. The idea being it's a hospitable environment for your yeast to get ready to go. And then you wanted that wort to chill down a bit, right? So that you could restrain any ester or phenol development. And,
I remember the early days of making extract beers. Quite often we would pitch warm just because we didn't really have a good method to cool it down very well.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the same there. My method was a dark closet in my apartment, you know. And nowadays, everyone's got their fermentation chambers and you know, all that. But we're still, for this series, I'll typically pitch at 74 degrees Fahrenheit. And then I do put it in my fermentation chamber. Big part of that is that where I live, it can get up to 115 degrees in the summertime. And, this isn't short and stupid. It's just short and shoddy. Our goal is to, with this series, I should have said earlier, actually, is to cut as many corners as we can without making a bad beer, right? And so we know that if we're fermenting anything but Kvike, apparently, at 80 plus degrees Fahrenheit, it's probably not going to end up being a good result.
But I mean, if you're pitching a little warm at the very beginning, as you mentioned, you're in that sort of rapid growth phase, right? The lag phase, where it's essentially mopping up oxygen and things like that, right?
So yeah, exactly.
So do you cut out the oxygen, or do you? I assume you probably oxygenate the wort.
So I have actually a little insider info about me. I've never owned an oxygen tank, and I've never felt the need to oxygenate my wort. Now, I don't brew huge beers. I tend to stick with 1060 or less for the most part. And so that being the case, what I've found is that, if most homebrewers are racking over a little bit of kettle trub into their, into their fermentation vessels. And that has a lot of nutrients that, and if you're racking with vigor, you're going to aerate that wort fairly well. I've never had an issue with extended lag. I've never had issues that I would look back and say, that's because I didn't oxygenate it. Now, I talk to people often who love brewing barley wine or, imperial stout. And again, I don't have experience with that necessarily, but I can understand, again, risk reduction, wanting to oxygenate that wort to do everything you can, for that yeast.
Yeah. I mean, I have switched over to using oxygen. I have noticed it does help, I think.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. We've done a couple experiments on it. I forget what the results are. We've done quite a few experiments. I do believe that oxygenating higher OG beers did have an impact, though.
Yeah, I mean, if you get high enough in gravity, sometimes you even oxygenate them twice, actually, and you can get away with it,
right?
For very high gravity beers.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you're making meads and wines, works as well.
Of course, yeah.
Anyway, so you mentioned you use warm wort. How warm do you actually go when you pitch this yeast?
So typically, it's interesting. Outside of wintertime, so there's about 9 months there where my groundwater doesn't really change temperatures. It stays about 72 to 74 degrees Fahrenheit. And using the chilling method that I do is an immersion chiller that I, shake up and down in the wort while the water's flowing through it. I can get my wort down to, 74 to 76 degrees Fahrenheit. And as soon as it's there, I rack it over to a fermenter. I don't really let the kettle trub settle too much. Now, I'm not pouring all of that trub into the fermentation vessel, but I don't worry about it too much. And then that's the point where I'll open up a pouch of yeast and pour it right in there.
So, and I assume you probably continue to chill you do get down to regular fermentation temperatures eventually, right?
Yeah, with the exception of a few styles, Saison, I might ferment that at 80 degrees or so. And then I haven't done a short and shoddy beer with a Kvike yeast yet, but, 100 degrees Fahrenheit apparently is perfectly fine with that stuff.
That's pretty amazing yeast, isn't it?
Oh, it's crazy. Whole family of yeast. It just amazes me that again, we're in a time where it all of a sudden people are talking about not just saying it's okay to do it, but they're encouraging you to do it. Kind of funny to me. But yeah, with lagers, I think that's where we get a lot of attention is that I do ferment every short and shoddy lager, which I believe we've done more of than ales, gets fermented at 66 degrees Fahrenheit or 19 degrees Celsius.
So that was one of the next topics I wanted to cover. You mentioned you do create a lot of lagers at ale temperatures, which I've done as well, and it can turn out just fine, right?
What we found, it's pretty interesting. We've done a ton of experiments comparing different lager, well, lagers fermented with different traditional lager strains at either around 50 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 C, or, you know, 66 to 68 Fahrenheit. That's 19 to 20 C. And for the most part, what we found, probably some of the most popular strains out there, the Pilsner Urquell strain and the Weihenstephan strain, people consistently cannot tell those beers apart based on fermentation temperature. And we've done, you know, kind of quicker lager fermentations where you pitch at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, let it sit for 4 or 5 days, and then slowly ramp that temperature up to like a diacetyl rest temperature. We've done very traditional where you just let it sit for a month, you know, at 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And still people just, there doesn't seem to be that big of a delta in the perceptible, you know, aroma and flavor characteristics between these lager beers with certain yeast fermented. And
I was going to mention that you mentioned that it is yeast dependent, right? Because some yeasts certainly do show the difference.
Yeah, and that's some of the more interesting findings. In fact, we did an experiment comparing the Grupo Modelo strain. That's a very popular Mexican lager strain, and yes. Tasters were indeed able to tell those beers apart when they were, one was fermented cool, one was fermented warm. Interestingly, a lot of the tasters in, you know, post survey conversations, when they were told what the experiment was, identified the warm fermented beers, the one tasting more like a lager than the cool fermented one. So, you know, what do you make of that? I did an experiment comparing, I believe it's the Augustiner strain, L17 Harvest from Imperial Yeast, one of my favorites. And they, you know, fermented warm, it tastes crisp and light and has that crackery malt character. And fermented cool, it has a little bit less of that. It's still clean and it's still good. But, you know, which one's more lager-like? To me, it was the warm fermented one. And you know, obviously that informs my decision these days.
which yeast strains have you had success with? Can you name a few of them?
Yeah, the three that I think most commonly that I would say, you know, I give the most recommendations for when people ask are the Pilsner Urquell strain, and I've done it with all of the different labs' versions. I believe that's WLP 800 from White Labs. That's the Urquell from Imperial. And we've also had a lot of luck with the Weihenstephan strain. That's the German lager. Very classic German lager. I believe they say it's the most popular lager yeast on the market right now. And then, like I was talking about, the L17 Harvest from Imperial Yeast. I'm not sure if you can get that specific strain from any other labs, but again, to me, that yeast just does a standout job, a remarkable job fermenting beers warm and really leaving what I consider to be kind of a classic lager flavor.
Have you played at all with pressure fermentation? We had Chris White and John Blickman on talking about how they were able to pressure ferment some of the lagers and actually get really good results with that at high temperature, obviously.
Yeah, pressure fermentation is an interesting variable to me because it seems like something that and we do this a lot in home brewing, where on the commercial scale, things don't necessarily transfer over to homebrewing perfectly. And pressurized fermentation so that you can ferment lagers warm seems like it might make sense on the commercial scale. In the times that we've tried it, we've done a pressure fermented lager fermented at 66F compared to a non-pressurized lager fermented at 66F. And they were indistinguishable. So I don't mean to, you know, step on toes, but it almost feels like we're looking for a way like an excuse to allow us to do this thing faster and warmer, without, you know, questioning convention too much. And I'm just not sure, at least on the homebrew scale, if the pressurization actually has much of an impact. Again, it requires more research, but
yeah, I'm just going over. They came on for an episode and they did talk to their results, which were done at a homebrew scale. It was done, I think, with one, I think like a cornicle fermenter or something like that. Mm. So they did it. I think it was a 5-gallon batch. And, of course Chris had access to the lab, so they're able to test the results. And they were able to show, you know, pretty conclusively that it did reduce the ester level by quite a bit when they went, you know, pressurized versus unpressurized.
Yeah, I find that fascinating.
And even at warm temperature, so.
Yeah. Yeah. And admittedly, you know, we don't have the access to lab equipment the way somebody like Chris White does. And I would love to, and there's what that kind of leaves me with the impression is that perhaps there are more esters in a warm fermented, non-pressurized lager than there are in a warm fermented pressurized lager. But does that reach the threshold of perceptibility? And that's, I guess, where I find it very interesting. I also find myself questioning a lot of what we've been taught. But you know, maybe it does. And more testing needs to be done.
Interesting. And then finally, you wanted to talk about, I think, let's see, gelatin was the next thing on the, obviously an easy way to clear your beer, right?
An easy way for people who are comfortable eating meat. Yes. there's a lot of, talk we get nowadays when using gelatin, you know, make sure you warn people that may or may not be, vegetarian or vegan, cause that's not good for them. But yeah, it seems to work incredibly well. You toss a little gelatin in after a day of cold crashing and, give it another 24, 48 hours and keg it up. And we'll see bright beer in less than a week.
And certainly cheaper than many of the alternatives. You can just buy, unflavored gelatin from the grocery store, right?
I've got a pail of Knox sitting in my cupboard that I use. And not only is it less expensive, but in my experience using, the various other, you know, post-fermentation finings, it really works faster and it's more effective. Again, it is a meat product, so you got to be careful about that. But other than that piece of it, it's an absolutely ideal. We got one guy on the crew who's convinced us all to refer to it as powdered thyme. So
nice. and you do something called burst carbonation. Can you talk about what burst carbonation is?
Yeah, burst carbonation. I'm sure I'm not the one to invent it. And in fact, I'm not even sure I came up with the term. But you know, for the most part, when you're kegging your beer, if you're using natural carbonation methods, you're putting some priming sugar in there, and you're capping off your keg and then letting it sit for 2 to 3 weeks to carbonate. If you're using traditional forced carbonation methods, you're connecting your CO2 to the tank at around 12 to 15 psi and leaving it for upwards of 10 days for it to fully carbonate.
That's pretty much what I do, yeah.
I think a lot of people do. I think that's perhaps still the most common method for carbonating these days. What we do, and this is more, I do this even when I'm not brewing short and shoddy, is I'll hit the beer with about 45 to 50 PSI and leave it overnight.
So are you doing that at room temperature or in the fridge, I guess?
I always cold crash. And so my beers are always cold. In the keg, I throw it in the keezer, which I keep at 36 degrees Fahrenheit. And then that's when I hit it with that high PSI of CO2. And you got to be careful because it's very, very easy to overcarbonate beer this way. And we have found that depending on the OG of that beer, you know, the strength of the beer, that it can take longer for higher OG beers to fully carbonate and much less time for, you know, if you're making a Berliner Weiss or something that's down there in the high twos or low threes.
I got to ask a procedural question. You say you hit it with 50 PSI. I assume you don't leave 50 PSI connected to it, right? You probably just hit it with 50 and then disconnect or what?
We leave it connected. The idea is to force as much CO2 into that solution as possible in as minimal time as possible. And it's an idea that I actually got when I was talking to a buddy of mine, a local professional brewer of mine, who was telling me that's basically how, you know, they're turning their beers around so quickly. Apparently it's fairly common. You rack a beer to the bright tank, and you're either carbonating it on the way using some expensive machine, I'm sure, or you're hitting it with a high PSI. CO2. And so that's what we've been doing. I've been doing it for 2 years now. And with the exception of a couple of batches that I forgot about, haven't had any issues with overcarbonation. Again, you just got to be careful. And the tip I give to people is if you're going for 45 PSI, you're probably safe for most styles of beer to go 15 hours until you reduce it. And you're going to take that, you know, take your disconnect off, purge the keg of the CO2 that's in there, and then put another disconnect on set at your serving pressure. You're not serving at 50 PSI. That'd be an utter mess.
So yeah, you probably don't want to connect it up to your keg system with it 50 PSI either, because it's going to blow all that beer into the other kegs, right?
Depending on the way your keg is set up, I don't even, if I have it higher than 30 PSI, which I'll do if I'm going out of town for a night or two. If I have it higher than that, I won't even connect. Yeah, I won't connect the faucets. I just leave it disconnected. So it's just connected to the gas.
Probably wise. Yeah, probably wise. Well, I'm just saying, if you got a multiple keg system and you connect it up, you know, you put a 50 PSI keg into your 10 PSI system, it's going to be quite a mess.
Yeah, it certainly can be. And I've heard horror stories, don't get me wrong. The beauty of the kegs that we're using, you know, for homebrewing, these Cornelius kegs, is that they're pressure tested up to 150 PSI or something. So we're well under that.
It's over 100. I don't know the exact number, but it is pretty high. Yeah.
And the only thing that I tell people is make sure your poppets are functioning properly. Cause if not, you'll walk to your keyser or your kegerator and see beer everywhere. And make sure you keep all of your O-rings well lubed. Again, you know, you don't want to lose a whole tank of gas because the O-ring had a crack in it or something.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just in general, how do you decide, which corners to cut? Do you do it based on your experiments or what else?
Yeah, the Short and Shoddy series was hugely influenced by the experiment findings. That's really what drove me wanting to try it out in the first place. Till this day, you know, we'll get an experiment result back that surprised me. And if I'm brewing a beer that calls for whatever method or variable that we tested, I'll be sure to integrate that just to see. You know, there's a lot of talk out there about, for as long as we've been doing this, one of the more common comments we get is, well, if you stack all of these variables, maybe one variable, you know, if you brew in a controlled enough manner, maybe just one variable won't have that big of an impact. But as you start to stack these variables on top of each other, you'll start to see, you know, greater impact, you know, basically the sum of all of these small parts. And so the Short and Shoddy series, again, was designed to kind of put that to the test. So they're all, every decision that we make is based off of an experiment result for these ones. We don't really mess around too much with, for example, style recipes. We want to stick to the style as closely as possible. It's really more process oriented. People think that I've been doing this for almost 6 years now, and I must be getting bored with it. Every time I brew a Short and Shoddy beer, I swear I feel the same way. You know, people do the first time they see that airlock bubble with a bat, you know, it's still so exciting for me. And then when that beer actually ends up being decent, it's thrilling, you know?
Nice. Well, Marshall, I want to get your closing thoughts on Short and Shoddy Brewing, Brewlosophy. You can certainly mention the podcast, some of the other things you got going on.
Yeah, we've got the Brewlosophy podcast where we talk about all the stuff we do on the website. If you're into listening to podcasts, I recommend you go subscribe over there. I think you'll enjoy it. You know, one of the things with Short and Shoddy that it doesn't get under my skin, but it gets close, is that people tend to interpret the fact that we got away with making a good beer using these crazy methods as a recommendation or as us saying you don't need to do these things or they don't matter. And that's not at all the point. To me, brewing is a fun hobby where we're given the freedom to kind of mess around a little bit. And yeah, there's, you know, I'm tickling kind of my science nerd piece of it, and others may want to tickle their traditionalist nerd, you know, part of themselves. We're not recommending that people go and brew this way. If you choose to do so, I think the results will speak for themselves. But there are certain things, certain corners you're absolutely not going to want to cut. You know, in my opinion, you want to make sure to stay sanitized and keep your stuff clean and be thoughtful throughout the brew process, whether that's 2 hours or 8 hours, you know. But it's definitely not a recommendation. And again, brewing is supposed to be fun, and that's what we're trying to keep it over here at Brewlosophy. So
really more things you can try, right?
Well, yeah, things you can try. And, you know, we live in a world where I think we like to be entertained, especially about stuff that we're interested in. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is provide something thought provoking for brewers out there. And in no way are we saying that those who came before us were wrong, or that, you know, you got to do it our way or you're not doing it right. We're just trying to have a good time with this. And I feel like, what's really validating to me is when I hear from folks who are kind of in the same position I am. I've got three kids, you know, all under the age of 12, who constantly need attention. And if I wake up at 8 o'clock while they're still in bed on a Saturday, I can knock out a batch of beer in 2 hours, just as it's time for them to eat breakfast, you know? And to me, I get to keep, you know, I get to stay in brewing because I can do that. I'd rather people do that, you know, and rely on these abbreviated methods than quit brewing altogether.
Well, Marshall, appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you for sharing again. So you always enjoy hearing about your experiments.
Yeah, it's always good chatting with you, Brad. And I just, again, I appreciate what you do for the brewing world, because I don't know anybody who's not using your software for beer design. So thank you for that, Brad.
Very kind. Thank you. Again, my guest today was Marshall Schott. He runs the brewlosophy.com website, focusing on brewing experiments, and also the Brewlosophy podcast, both excellent resources. Thank you again, Marshall.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, a big thank you to Marshall Schott for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automatic step mashing, boil timers, and advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith Brewing Software a try. I've just released a new Beersmith 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial today, go to beersmith.com. Again, that's beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.